Welcome to CoreCast, Seton Hall University's podcast series supporting the university core curriculum. Produced by the Institute for Communication and Religion and generously funded by the Division of Academic Affairs, each episode will bring a faculty expert together with a student leader to discuss and explore a core text. The Catholic intellectual tradition is rich and varied, and actively seeks to engage all global wisdom traditions. Join us in learning about Scripture and the world's greatest works of philosophy and literature. Thanks so much for joining us on CoreCast. My name is Bernie Wagenblast. Well, today we're going to be talking about an allegory. We'll get into more details of exactly what that allegory is, but we want to welcome our two guests who are here with us. We have Gregory Floyd. He is the director of the Center for Catholic Studies at Seton Hall University. Dr. Floyd has a PhD in philosophy and teaches in the Core Department and Honors Program at Seton Hall. And we're also joined by Joseph Brennan, who is a student in the School of Diplomacy and International Relations. He's a member of the Honors Program and the Bassino Leadership Institute. Joey, Greg, welcome to CoreCast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you here, and we're going to be talking about a topic that perhaps some of the listeners, perhaps many of the listeners, are not familiar with. We're going to be talking about Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Why don't we start off, Greg, with you telling me a bit, what is Plato's Allegory of the Cave? Give me the Cliff Notes version, or even shorter, if you would, please.
Sure. So Plato is, of course, an ancient philosopher, a thinker from ancient Greece. Student of Socrates, teacher to Aristotle, the three great figures of ancient Greek philosophy. And Plato decided to write his philosophical thinking in the form of dialogues that involve different characters expressing and debating different ideas. And one of his most influential dialogues is called The Republic, a dialogue about what it would mean to create a just city. And within that dialogue, we get perhaps his most enduring story, philosophical fable or parable, if you want, called the Allegory of the Cave. And he says it's an allegory about human learning, how our souls, meaning our minds, come to understand or how they suffer from lack of understanding. And we discuss it in our core and honors classes. I imagine if any of the listeners had any philosophy in their undergraduate experience, they probably came across Plato's Allegory of the Cave. It's kind of a mainstay of the history of philosophy.
Joey, why don't we get your perspective on it? You are a freshman, I believe, here at Seton Hall. Were you familiar with this allegory before you became a student?
I was not. I knew basically nothing about Plato. The Honors Program has really helped me to understand ancient Greek philosophers and their ideas and how our society today has kind of culminated all of them and used them while we build and progress forward in history.
What was your initial reaction when you first were introduced to the allegory of the cave? You know, some people think of philosophy as, oh, that's kind of out there. That really doesn't have any real world relevance. But it does in many ways. I'm curious to get your take on how you felt about it when you first were introduced to it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the allegory itself, when isolated, you can't really take a lot from it. But when you put it into context of history and the entirety of the Republic, you can really get the sense of what Plato is trying to teach us through the lens of understanding and learning and how to make sure that the reality you're seeing and understanding is true reality and not one of falsehood.
Mm-hmm. Greg, perhaps you can give us a little bit of scene setting, if you would,
sure,
in terms of where was Greece at this time when this was written? Tell us a little bit of the background, so to speak, of where we were in history with Greece at that time.
Okay. Joe, you can correct me if I get any of the details wrong. So Plato is living in the 4th century. He's a wealthy aristocrat. He's well-educated. Some scholars suggest that he was on his way to being a decorated writer of Greek plays and tragedies, a sort of prestigious office in the ancient Greek city. And he encounters this figure of Socrates at some point in his life, is sort of radically reoriented, changed in some way, and he decides to devote his talents to writing what we sometimes call myths, but myths that illustrate stories, parables, fables, if you want, that illustrate real claims about the nature of reality, about the nature of human community, about kind of human aspirations and foibles and failures and fallenness, all these sorts of things. In this case, Plato is, in a way, commemorating his teacher, Socrates. the father of philosophy, who's executed for what he teaches, because it's perceived that the questioning of traditional and ideas and customs that have been long held by the city, questioning those in ways that cause them to be revisited and reevaluated, is threatening to the stability of political life. Mm-hmm. And the young men of Athens who are going to supplant their fathers as the leaders of the city are the ones sort of most drawn to him and most curious about what he has to offer. And it's taking place in the middle of a war, the Peloponnesian War, which Athens is about to lose, in part because of betrayal of one of their young generals who was very taken with Socrates. Mm-hmm. So there's some complicated layers here. The cave itself is a fairly straightforward story. What it means is the deeper sort of philosophical work of a group of people who Plato suggests are born or at least come to be aware of themselves as chained in a cave, facing a wall in darkness that's broken only by the fire behind them, and that there are people sort of giving a puppet show. They have figures of reality, trees and, I don't know, horses and things like that, that they march in front of the flames and that cast a shadow on the wall. And Plato's suggestion is these people look at those shadows and give names to those shadows and think that they've understood reality. But the way the story goes, one of them is freed and sort of forced up out of the cave into the natural sunlight and begins to see trees and horses and rivers and mountains and even the sun itself as they truly are. And that this is both a bewildering and a difficult experience, but one on the other side of it, that the freed prisoner, this liberated mind, really comes to be enlightened by, to understand not just shadows of things in the cave, but things as they are and the things that cause the things. The sun is the source of growth and life that causes them to be. And then, well, I'll let Joey speak to, there's sort of a twist ending. What happens after this enlightened philosopher is sort of out there just enjoying the natural world?
So, spoiler alert.
Yeah, exactly.
So after the philosopher is released and exits the cave, he decides to go back and into the cave and try to help release some of the other prisoners. And at that point, there's some discrepancy among the prisoners on kind of like a basic level of, do we want to go out or do we not, and do we want to stay here? And part of that is due to just kind of the prisoners' comfort in the cave and their comfort in understanding their reality in the cave and not wanting to venture out into the unknown and what potentially could hurt their own image of reality. Mm. So, yeah, I think that's basically the end twist there. And a lot of the prisoners are uncomfortable with leaving the cave, and they don't want to because, like I said before, they're comfortable with what they see, the shadows on the wall. They're comfortable with not knowing what is outside because they don't know what is outside. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing to be concerned about because they don't know.
What you don't know, you don't know.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ignorance is bliss, right? Yeah. Socrates doesn't think so, but.
Greg, when you were describing this, you used the word parable. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously a connection to the Bible in that sense. Mm-hmm. The Bible is filled with parables. Mm-hmm. Jesus used parables to share truths with his disciples and followers about different things that weren't necessarily real life events, but told a story and told the truth. Is that sort of in the same tradition of what Socrates is doing here with this allegory?
I believe so. Socrates, of course, predates the gospel authors, at least, by about 400 years, at least, maybe even five. But the insight's the same, that especially for difficult truths, we often have to approach them kind of indirectly. And telling a story about someone else in some other place confronting some other situation lets us see what ought to happen. And then we can turn and apply that to ourselves and realize we ought to be maybe doing things we aren't doing or ought not to be doing things we are doing. And I see Plato doing that very much, that this is, you know, I know the last podcast was about the Good Samaritan, right? Mm-hmm. And in a way, it doesn't matter what the name of the Good Samaritan is, right? Or the address he belonged at in Samaria. The point is, but there's real truth there, even though the historicity or the historical truth of the characters isn't kind of what's at stake. Mm-hmm. I think in the cave, it's the same way. We don't need to know the name of the prisoner. The prisoner, in a way, is left anonymous on purpose because Plato's claim is it's each of us. And that what this is really about is a story that helps us see the dynamics of learning and of the refusal to learn, right? Of bias or willful ignorance. That the greatest, I mean, what I try to do with my students like Joey in class is say, I think really what Plato shows us, and Joey alluded to it, is that the cave is actually comfortable. From the outside, we see prisoners chained, staring at illusions of reality, or at least sort of derivations that aren't as true as the real things themselves. But what the prisoners see is just what they've always known.
Mm-hmm.
And this struggle out of to climb out of the cave is presented by Plato with harsh words, right? The prisoner has to be forced and dragged and climbed, and it's painful. And I do think for all of us at kind of crucial moments of our life, and maybe especially for college students early in their careers, you're confronted by information that can tend to destabilize what you thought you knew about the world, or at least cause you to qualify it and nuance it and develop it in ways that you didn't think were necessary prior to this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what Plato raises for us is, what do we do when we're confronted with questions we can't answer from out of the resources of what we already believe? And in that sense, I think what he's suggesting is that ignorance isn't a threat to knowledge. In fact, ignorance is learning you don't know what you thought you knew is actually the first step towards knowledge. It's actually comfort that's mm-hmm. the greatest threat, wanting to stay where we are with what we know rather than move into this sunlit realm that, again, looks great from the outside. But if you're the character in the story, all you know is, it's like, I tell my students, it's like coming out of a movie theater, right? You went in at 3 p.m. and now it's 7 and it's the winter and it's dark and you're kind of disoriented, right? And that's the experience of learning is one that's fraught with sort of drama and difficulty. Ultimately, it's very meaningful. But Plato's kind of very clear about it doesn't feel meaningful mm-hmm. in its early stages, and it often can feel really conflicting and confusing as we move from what we thought we knew to a truer account of the world around us.
Joey, Greg talked about how there is some connection to what a new college student feels. You've come from high school, which quite possibly were some of the people that you grew up with over the years, your hometown perhaps, and now you're in a university where there are people from around the world that you're with, and you're learning new things and new subjects, and life is just totally different from what it had been prior to coming to college. Do you see a little bit of yourself, in a sense, of like that prisoner who was brought out and into the sunlight and experiencing this for the first time?
Yeah, I definitely try to see myself in that. Part of my experiences here at Seton Hall so far have definitely taken me out of my comfort zone, and I think that's something that the philosopher and the free prisoner experiences, leaving the cave and leaving their comfort zone, and that's something that I've experienced, and also, but also like the concept of learning and also unlearning that the freed prisoner experiences, learning how to lead a new life in a new reality. And I think that's something every new college student experiences. It's a whole new environment. But also the process of unlearning, and kind of for me, unlearning the sheltered high school life where now I'm much more free and have much more access to a wide variety of different opportunities. Where in high school, you're much more sheltered and you just have a lot more like protection and fallback, and kind of unlearning that and learning how to like fend for yourself, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I think back to when I was going from high school into college here at Seton Hall, and although it was still very many years ago, I do remember some of the feelings that I had at the time. And one of the things that comes to mind is, as you're younger, you learn things in school, and it's almost as if these are laws, and this is the way it's always going to be, and these things don't change. But I think one of the things we learn as a college student is that what we thought we knew isn't necessarily always the same, and what we know today may change as we get more information further down the line. Tell me a little bit about that perspective, if you will, from your perspective as a freshman who's only been here four months or so?
Yeah, so I think from a high school perspective, looking at college, you see colleges with tens of thousands of people just kind of being swamped in a large group of people that, and you're just a small fish in the sea. And I think, especially at Seton Hall, that's not the case. But also, you talked about rules and like how we have to abide by those, and how those rules are kind of stricken in us at high school about college, and I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that every person's college experience is unique, but I think that following the rules in college, I mean, obviously, like, the institution has rules that you need to follow, but I think that there are definitely exceptions, and there's definitely a path for everyone. Mm. Like, the rules don't constrict everyone to one career path or one opportunity. I think that, especially the way Seton Hall does it, there's a wide range and room for flexibility, and I think that you're able to choose what you want to do using the resources that are provided to you without breaking rules, per se.
Greg, when you're teaching this, mm-hmm. is it primarily freshmen that you're teaching?
Most often, yeah.
I'm curious, Joey's one example, but there are obviously many mm-hmm. students that mm-hmm. you're teaching now and have taught over the years, taught this allegory to. How do you make what they learn through this allegory relevant to contemporary readers in a digital age?
Yeah, excellent. I have two thoughts on that. In one of my slides I like to use, I found an artist sort of reworking of the parable of the cave, where the cave wall is a huge computer screen. Mm-hmm. And it's populated with, like, the symbols and icons of all the, like, major news networks and media networks and social media networks. And I think there's like a self-evident relevancy of this question of are the man-made, the human-made images of reality we have really true to reality, right? And there's this tension in Plato on the one hand between questioning what we think we know, but the goal of that is to deepen our pursuit of reality, of truth in some way, right? So there's this humility about the limits of human knowing, that we often think we know what we don't really know, or we think we have good reasons that turn out not to be as stable or substantial as we thought they were. But the goal of that sort of self-awareness is to double down on a desire and the pursuit of understanding the world as it really is. Mm-hmm. Because there's a way in which the cave suggests that ignorance might be bliss for the people in the cave, but it still has real consequences for themselves and others. And so we want to understand what the consequences sort of our actions and of our beliefs really are. I always thought Plato, as I said, there's some suggestion that he was maybe on his way to being a great playwright, and the details matter to him. They're not just lots of extra adjectives, sometimes mm-hmm. the way my students add them to their papers. Not Joey. And two of the details I've always been fascinated by are Plato says that the prisoners' necks are chained and that their feet are chained. And I think that's suggestive that if you don't know what the good is, you can't do it, right? You can't move towards it. And so there's this link. It's a parable, or it's a myth about learning, but that becomes a myth about sort of living, kind of ethics, right? If I don't know that I'm really, you know, working towards what's truly good, I could be accidentally working towards what's not good, right? Or what's compromised in some way. And I could kind of waste all my great youthful energy in the pursuit of something I come to regret. And so this need for careful reflection, knowing that we never have all the answers and all the information, but we can still make real progress, is kind of what I take from it. The second, for me as a teacher, the very beginning of the parable, the allegory says, this is an image about human nature as it's educated and as it lacks education. So it's a parable about, or a story about learning. And I've taken that to heart, because what Plato actually draws our attention to is not like new ideas, but a deeper understanding of the process of learning. It's less that the guy in the cave or the woman in the cave has just swapped one set of arbitrary beliefs for a different set of arbitrary beliefs, but that they've realized the work it takes to examine their beliefs. And I, as a first-year instructor, I think that is always my primary goal with students in our core and honors classes, is to say, this is about learning how to think, not about memorizing X, Y, and Z rather than A, B, and C, but learning how to evaluate, assess, and maybe more deeply ground the things that matter to you, or to question them, mm-hmm. right? If they turn out to be not as substantial or not as kind of stable as you thought they were, to be okay with that sort of confusion and difficulty, but in a way that inspires you to get it right, mm-hmm. right? Not to give up on it altogether.
You talked about this a little bit, but I want to delve into it a little deeper. For many people, education and learning are synonymous, but there mm-hmm. is a difference, isn't there?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think Plato gives us, philosophers have called this the first philosophy of education, right? And it's not without its problems, but it's a clear set of claims about how human beings are wired to learn about the world and how that can go wrong and what it takes to do it right. And I think in that sense, it's a helpful like vantage point or perspective outside of the present moment we're in, where education tends to be something that you earn by paying for it and getting a piece of paper that gets you a job, right? And that's perfectly reasonable. We understand why people think that. But Plato proposes a much more comprehensive vision of education. Right? He actually calls it, the Greek word would translate to something like soul craft, like crafting your sort of interior disposition, soul, personality, kind of relationship to the world. And that that is like the deepest and fullest form of an education. And then that requires not memorizing facts, as important as those may be, not training for a particular career in the world, as important as that may be, but sort of developing the kind of skills that are going to serve you as a human being in all the different dimensions of your life and in any career you might choose for yourself. And I'd like to think that our core and honors programs in particular are dedicated to those sort of universal human skills. Thinking, evaluating, assessing, especially in a digital age, right? What sorts of information are serious and scholarly and reliable, and what presents itself as true but is really a passing opinion on the internet, of which we know there are multitudes.
Joey, you are a student in the Diplomacy and International Relations School. How do you see philosophy playing a role in not just the rest of your career here at Seton Hall, but what you're going to do after you graduate? How do you see that playing a part in your thinking and how you operate in this world?
Yeah, so part of the honors program is reading philosophy from all over the world. And I think that specific aspect is vital to a degree in diplomacy and international relations, just kind of understanding each culture and geographical area's thinking and reason why they believe in what they believe. And I think that philosophy gives that reason. I think philosophy helps people and outsiders to understand foreign cultures and foreign ideas. I think that with the Diplomacy and International Relations degree, it's important to understand that, and you need to understand that in order to work with other people. And the whole point of diplomacy and international relations is working with people who are different from you and working with people who have contrasting beliefs and who don't agree with what you say. And with philosophy, it goes right, it goes hand in hand. I mean, part of Allegory of the Cave is when the prisoner, free prisoner comes back, the other prisoners say, like, his eyes have been ruined because he's seen all these new things. And they haven't, like, his eyes have been ruined. And I think those prisoners haven't been exposed to new ideas, and they haven't been exposed to people who disagree with them, so they automatically don't like the person who does disagree with them. And I think if you don't have that in your life, you don't have people who don't disagree with you, you're not going to be able to work with other people, especially in diplomacy.
I think you bring up a very interesting point that is very relevant to where we are right now in the life of the United States, where people are said to live in their own information silos, and they hear information that just reinforces what they already believe, and they're not exposed to differing points of view and differing perspectives on different things. Do you feel that that's accurate saying that?
Yeah, I do think that's accurate. I think that for me personally, when I go or I hear a story and I go to do research about it, I try to go in with an open mind. Obviously, I have a preconceived notion about what I believe and what I think, but I try not to go into the internet looking for sources that back up what I think, but sources that try and reveal what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Because there are sources that corroborate both sides. Like, you can find any source anywhere that says what you think, but it's harder to try and find reliable and scholarly sources that give an objective opinion about what's happening and not necessarily backing your stance up.
Mm-hmm. Greg, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a great question. I think one of the very human insights of Plato's philosophy is that people change people's minds, not kind of more writing, thinking media. And I think that's why he writes in a dialogue form, showing people engaging in sometimes very tense and disagreeable conversation, but about things that they recognize they both care about, even if they think very differently about them. It also suggests to me that part of what Plato says, when the allegory ends, he gives the example of a wicked person who's very smart, right? And there's this sense that education, if it's sort of deracinated, kind of cut off from its roots, can train people to be very clever arguers, but in a way, he says, they're not turned towards the right things, right? They don't care about the right things, and so all their intelligence serves to reinforce their own biases and serves to let them pursue their own sort of selfish ends. And I think there's an insight there that education alone, like being smart or clever in that sense, doesn't guarantee that you're a good person. And conversely, that what enables you to begin reevaluating your sort of commitments, right, in ways that would deepen your own moral sensibility or your ethical sensibility, is precisely coming to care about and love other people. And that for a philosopher to say that, who's so clearly committed to the intellectual life, but also is aware of the ways in which that's always embedded in interpersonal relationships, and that when those are working well, right, in the context of the ancient Greek way of saying it would be in the context of friendships, rich friendships, destabilize our biases, right, in ways that let reason do its work in sort of bringing us to a closer contact with and a greater appreciation of the world as it really is. And so I think, you know, what Plato suggests for a fractured political community is that sharing a meal together, or he would say getting in the living room and sharing a lot of wine together, as one of his dialogues does, could be as important as sort of having principled debates about political or ethical or moral or religious ideas, that there's something about the context in which we have these conversations, and that in a way we have to prepare for that by learning to actually care for people who think differently than we do. And I'd like to think, you know, in our core and honors classes, where you have these smaller classes of people who are spending more time together than they are in a passing class for their majors, the opportunity to begin cultivating friendships, intellectual friendships, where there's sort of an expectation that you don't just spend time together, but you talk about things that matter and that are tricky and that are difficult, kind of begins some of that philosophical work of a kind of full education.
Gray, you mentioned, of course, Plato did not write this in English. He wrote it, I assume, in Greek.
That's correct.
And you know, I know when I've done Bible studies, I don't know Greek, but as the teacher has taught, there are nuances that are lost in translation. Mm-hmm. Words that we may use in English, like love, may have different meanings, agape, mm-hmm. or eros, mm-hmm. Philia, those types of
yes.
variations on one English word of love. Do you think reading this in the original Greek gives an even deeper understanding of what Plato was saying?
Mm. So a proviso, I do not read ancient Greek consistently, so I have not read this at length in Greek. I have studied a number of the key terms that Plato uses, and maybe I'll just highlight two quickly. I suggested the first, the word for education is the word we get pedagogy from, and it includes what we might call today whole person education, or kind of like something closer to human formation, that it's not just about sharpening your mind's ability to do a particular craft for the city, like write laws or shoe horses or go to war effectively, but about how your intellectual life is tied to your moral and interior emotional, but also social and civic lives, right? That all these things need to be in harmony with one another for a person to be considered educated. And that an educated person, someone whose soul has been shaped in the right way, is someone who sees their various obligations and identities as citizen and inquirer and maybe sibling or parent or member of the community as being integrated in a holistic way. And ultimately that's for the Greeks what wisdom is, not just scientific knowledge or practical knowledge, but this sense for how the whole fits together and how we navigate our very complicated and demanding lives with more success rather than less success, right? None of us do it perfectly, but we know there are moments where we've done it better than in the past, or where we've done it better in the past than we're doing it at the moment, right? And that is, in a way, the beginning of what the Greeks, I think, at least some of them, consider wisdom to be, this sort of knowing how to survive, how to cope with, and how to flourish, if possible, within the concrete realities that we're all a part of, and that often pull us in different directions. The other word that comes up that'll be very important for later philosophy is the Greek word aitia, which is the word for cause, trying to understand what causes something. And that's the word that the parable or the allegory uses when the prisoner leaves the cave and understands that the sun is what causes growth and light and reality, in a sense, to be the way that it is. And so there's a deepening of what it might mean to know something here, right? Knowing facts knowing that things are the case isn't always knowing how or why they've come to be that way. And I think especially as we look at some of our most divisive issues, as one author I like likes to say, we don't ask the questions behind the questions, mm-hmm. right? Like not just how did this happen, but why did it happen, right? Mm-hmm. And what led to it? And only those kinds of questions can give us more comprehensive solutions to the things that ail us most, I think, politically and socially.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I want to thank both of you for taking the time out to chat with me and educate me a little bit about this and perhaps cause me to want to learn a little bit more about this. It was my introduction to The Allegory of the Cave. We've been talking on the CoreCast podcast with Greg Floyd. He is the director of the Center for Catholic Studies at Seton Hall University, and Joseph Brennan, who is a freshman student. Here at Seton Hall. Joey, Greg, thank you both so much for taking the time out to chat with me today.
Great to be with you, Bernie. Thank you.
Thank you.